Hello, and welcome to You've Got Time, an Orange is the New Black podcast. As usual, I'm your hostess, Erin Quayle, and we are coming to the end. We have actually reached the end of Orange is the New Black Season 4. This episode focuses on the final episode of the season, number 13, which is called Toast Can't Never Be Bread Again. And we had a great conversation with Jamie Broadnax, who is the managing editor and founder of Black Girl Nerds, which is like a really great community online. You can find them on Twitter, Facebook, all sorts of places talking about pop culture and, you know, specifically Black Girl Nerds and pop culture and the Black Girl Nerds who love pop culture as well. So she took some time out to speak with us about the final episode of the season. And we kind of got in deep on, you know, the portrayal of Black Lives Matter, the missed opportunities that the show didn't take, and the lack of diversity in the Orange is the New Black writers room, and sort of a whole host of things came up in our conversation, and we had a really great chat. So, but tomorrow, which is Thursday, September 29th, the second part of our finale discussion will drop, and that is focusing specifically on grief and loss, since I know, you know, the loss of Poussey was such a big deal for Orange is the New Black fans. We talked to a grief and loss therapist about it, and we're kind of breaking down the, you know, the psychological background of grief and loss as it, you know, as it relates to just grief and loss in general, as well as the episode, and as well as the loss of Poussey and the loss of fictional characters in general too. So please stay tuned for that tomorrow. In addition, we wanted to let you guys know that we are not stopping after the final, the final episode of the season. We will be periodically, hopefully once a month, posting episodes about things relating to the show. Hopefully, you know, addiction, trauma. We have an interview set up in a couple weeks with a group that brings arts programs to prisons in New York. So, you know, a lot more fun, interesting stuff is coming down, and we hope you guys stay tuned for that as well. So until then, please enjoy the first part of our discussion on the emotional Orange is the New Black season 4 finale, and we hope to talk to you guys soon. Please contact us if you have any questions, comments, concerns, or you just want to chat. You can reach us at Twitter at You've Got Time Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ You've Got Time Podcast, and also you can just send us an old-fashioned email at youvegottimepodcast@gmail.com. So thanks so much, guys. Bye. So let's just jump right into the episode. So I know, you know, this is the last episode of the season. It's you know, it's been a long journey with the podcast and talking about every episode and kind of breaking it down, and it was really, you know, interesting to rewatch this one. So, you know, obviously following Poussey's death, the prison's super in crisis. You know, no one really knows how to handle the situation. But it's interspersed with these Poussey flashbacks, and we've had flashbacks with Poussey before. Here it feels like very positive and magical. So, how do you feel about the Poussey flashbacks in the last episode?
Well, it was the most that we ever got of Poussey's story in all, what, 4 seasons of the show. It's just very interesting that we got snippets of her background and her origin story, so to speak, in the very last moments of her life and even postmortem. So it's very unfortunate that we didn't get to learn. There were parts of her story that, you know, they did do flashbacks in previous seasons, but it just seems like we got so much more in this last season than we've got during the whole entire run of this series. So it's unfortunate that we didn't get to learn more about who Poussey was and what her motives are and, you know, why she is the person that she is. But, you know, that's one of the biggest criticisms that I have about this show, how they tend to focus on nuance towards white characters and even tertiary white characters, but not so much on, you know, supporting and even, you know, I would consider Poussey to be one of the leads of the show. So, yeah, it's just unfortunate. But the writer's room does reflect and make sense why the women of color are marginalized so much in the material.
Right. And I know, you know, that was something that sort of, you know, came up after the season was, you know, put out there and everyone sort of reacted to the finale. And we'll get to, you know, all the feels and all of the beats of the finale. But I'm glad you brought up the writer's room point, because I was definitely surprised to learn that there were no or very few people of color on the writing staff. I think maybe there's one or two, and no African-American individuals on the staff. So, you know, it was just very interesting.
Or Latino.
And those are two gigantic populations that the show is representing. And so, but my question, you know, to you is, for me, you know, I've worked in, you know, substance abuse clinics for a long time. I've, you know, been around people of, you know, diverse people, but I just, in trying to get diverse people on the podcast, like people of, you know, different backgrounds, different races, different, all sorts of stuff, it's kind of hard to break out, I think, of your, like, of the group that you know. And I kind of sympathized with the Orange is the New Black staff a little bit, being like, maybe they didn't really like, obviously they had some sort of concept of what was going on, but maybe they were trying to kind of break out but couldn't. I don't really know, like, the specifics behind that, but I feel like just in general it's hard for us to kind of break out of our racial groups once we, like, have them established.
I always find that to be a very odd thing when, because I've had conversations. I had done an interview a few years ago about the tech industry with these white guys, and they were kind of saying the same thing, that they work with these startup companies, and it's so hard to find a diverse team of people to recruit to their firm. And I don't understand why it's so hard. I mean, I'm on Twitter all the time, 24/7, it seems. And I think I've been exposed to so many more people in different spaces, not even just within the racial spectrum, but even, you know, people in the LGBTQ community, people with disabilities. I've seen so many different groups form because of my engagement on Twitter. So I just always find it so hard to believe. There's so many nonprofit organizations, there's Twitter chats, there's Tumblr blogs, and just like these very there's these communities of people who are marginalized voices that kind of come together and are using the internet as a way to become a collective, and Black Girl Nerds is certainly a part of one of those many groups. But I mean, they're there, right there in front of my face. And if I was a white person, I'd be like, okay, wow, there's so much to choose from. I could totally go outside of my sphere of influence and bring people in. So I don't know. I guess as a person of color, just always not having the kind of privilege that allows me to only be within a certain group of people that look like me. I guess it's hard for me to fathom that, but, you know, I guess everybody's experience is different, but I don't buy the fact that it's difficult to find people of color, and also people of just different nationalities and backgrounds, you know, in various spaces, whether you want to talk about things in the tech industry, whether you want to have conversations regarding race and writing and just anything that you really want to talk about. I just feel like there's definitely opportunities out there to reach out, and it's not as hard as people can assume.
Right. I do think it takes, you know, you and I are speaking now, and you're definitely being very generous with your time, because I know you're incredibly busy, but, you know, with Black Girl Nerds and all the other things that you do. But, you know, it does take, I think, some effort, especially on the part of people who are maybe a little bit more, you know, not necessarily exposed to things in their everyday life, or like different cultures and different races in their everyday lives.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's hard for me to understand how it's hard for other people to reach out to people that aren't either, that don't share the same cultural background as them, that don't share the same religious experience as them, that are not their same gender. I just find that hard to believe. And even living, I don't live there anymore, but when I used to live in New York City, just sitting on the train station and, you know, it looks like a huge rainbow coalition of so many people, internationally, like people talking in these different languages. It's just, I don't know. I can't see it. It's hard to say that it's not, easy to find, people of different backgrounds, but I don't know.
Right. Yeah. And I think different, you know, some people maybe are scared of what's different, or
I think that I totally agree. I think there's a fear. I think that there's people out there that just, and also there's a sensitivity to, well, if I ask about this that is centered around race, am I feeling like, you know, I'm only reaching out to them because they're Black? Like, I think that that is something that white people tend to be concerned about. But, you know, there are so many of us that want an opportunity to speak. And especially if you are someone who is white, that has a platform that has access to so many people, that's, you know, on a mainstream level, then give people of color that opportunity, because, you know, we don't have the kind of privilege that that white people have to be able to, you know, reach the masses. And if you want to bring in a person of color to, you know, give the Black perspective, I think that's cool. At the same time, we shouldn't always be the authority on our race and our Blackness. And as women, we shouldn't always have to be the authority on what it is to be a woman. Right. But yeah, I agree with you. I think fear is definitely a part of that. And I apologize. I didn't mean to interrupt you when you
made that point. I do think that that's definitely a big part of it too. You know, I was talking on the last episode with, the girl that I was talking on that episode with, and we're both white women, and I was kind of speaking to the fact that I was trying to get, you know, more diversity on the podcast in terms of the individuals that I was talking to. And I had a few, you know, people of color on the podcast, but it's mostly white people, because those are the people that agreed to be on the podcast, even though I did ask, you know, a larger, more diverse group of people to be on. And sometimes it was, you know, they didn't watch the show, or there were certain, you know, roadblocks prohibiting me from making the show more diverse than I wanted it to be. So, you know, I definitely wanted to address that, especially given the parallel to the Orange is the New Black writer's room this season. So, you know, I'm glad that, you know, I'm glad we're talking about it. And I'm glad you agree with that assessment, because I don't feel like people should be afraid. Like, I think your mentioning of New York City and looking around, it kind of mirrors the part in the episode where Pusey is sitting on the subway, and there's, I think, like an Asian lady with her son, and there's a, you know, an Indian man looking at Pusey, and they share a moment, and it's sort of just a, you know, a catch-all on this one subway car on the way to Brooklyn. And I think that that's, you know, that's, it's, it was a beautiful moment in the episode.
Yeah. I mean, I don't understand how our reality can't be reflected in fiction. I mean, I know it's fiction and it's not real, but it is a, you know, it's like a simulated reality of sorts. This is based off of women that live in prison, and it's based off of a system that exists. And many of the characters that are in Orange is the New Black are people that could easily be real life individuals having these same experiences. So it's not like these are aliens or anything like that. So I don't understand, you know, why the writer's room can't reflect the very people that are characters, you know, that look like the characters, I should say, on the show. So that's it's just an issue of, you know, that there's a lot of systemic racism and oppression that happens in all areas of life. And when it comes to the writer's room, especially, I think it really makes me more upset than anything else, because I don't always want my story or stories of women that look like me to be told through a white lens. And then also I know so many women who are, you know, Black women and women of color who are really great, super talented writers. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, why is this person not hired? And it's like seeing that coupled with so many other white writers that get opportunities and seeing very talented Black women and women of color not getting those kind of opportunities. That also is something that I think triggers a lot of people. And that's why the criticism is there, because there's so few of us in the writer's room. So anyway, I could talk about that kind of subject all day.
I mean, there are fewer in the writer's room. There are fewer behind the camera. I mean, Ava DuVernay is definitely like an exception, and she's all over right now because she's, you know, developing A Wrinkle in Time, which I'm so excited about. But, you know, there are opportunities. And I always kind of go back. I don't know if you know that incident that happened on Project Greenlight last season with Effie Brown and Matt Damon. But to kind of just give a little context, there's a African-American producer, I believe she is, or an executive. She's behind the scenes in a lot of movies and TV shows and such. And Matt Damon sort of came back at her when she said that a woman should be behind the camera, sort of trying to express things. And he said, you can take care of that in casting. And so there was this whole big thing about how that's not really where you have to, you know, Orange is the New Black is really great at diverse casting. But behind the scenes, I think that, you know, there's much room for improvement.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Effie Brown was the producer that had that exchange with Matt Damon, and she was a guest on my podcast, and I brought up that question. Yeah, she was a guest, and, you know, I brought it up to her, like, you know, what was going on with that? And, you know, she very carefully answered that, you know, this is a conversation that we've been having for a long time and, you know, in other circles. And when this was brought up again, you know, she had to be very careful of how she articulated her opinions to him, because God forbid if she has any sort of tone in her voice or she has any sort of indication of anger, then she gets labeled as the angry Black woman, which is a really terrible trope that immediately tries to, that people try to immediately use against us to, you know, dismiss us in a lot of ways. So, you know, yeah, she really, she spoke to that. And, it's again, that is an issue that is so pervasive in Hollywood, is producers like Matt Damon and others believe that as long as you see people of color in front of the camera, then that is diversity. But what happens behind the camera doesn't matter. But what happens behind the camera is what gives us access. It's what allows us to tell other stories that feature people of color and women. And, you know, not having that kind of access, then again, we're either dismissed or our stories are erased in some way, our stories are compromised. And then you get situations like Orange is the New Black, where, yes, we're happy to have diverse characters, but whose stories are you really telling? Whose stories are you focusing on? Why are characters who are not really that relevant to the story having a very nuanced telling of their narrative? So, you know, and it kind of all comes back around in this big vicious cycle.
That's true. And it's interesting because throughout this season, with different conversations that I've had with people, we've talked about how the men are never drawn in like a complex way, or they're drawn to be villains more often or incompetent. Like there's never a man that has like redeeming qualities. So I think it's just interesting that, you know, because the writer's room is predominantly female and white, that comes through in all the episodes, whether it's for men. I mean, obviously this isn't a show for men and white men don't need more, you know, portrayals of positive portrayals of them on television. But, you know, it's definitely telling because you can see that trickle down from the creatives behind the show. You can see it trickle down, even if it's not necessarily intentional.
Yeah, I mean, I think I forgot the name of the correctional officer that killed Poussey. Bailey. Was it Bailey? Yeah. I think that he really wasn't vilified at all. You know, they went so far as to make him someone who was this really nice, innocent, sweet guy. And he worked, what was it, at an ice cream shop or something? Mm-hmm. You know, so they really, and obviously not, you know, we don't want to tag all cops, all law enforcement, all correctional officers as bad people, obviously. But I didn't understand the need to show this man's story, why you wanted to make him seem so human after he did what he did. Rather than focusing on that, they should have focused on why he's insensitive to, you know, pinning a female down who's half of his size and thinking that that's okay. Right. You know, what is it about you that triggers you to think that it's okay to use excessive force on a woman like that?
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm just saying who didn't appear as a threat at all to you. So, you know, I rather them focus on that, telling like what is it in your psyche that makes you believe that that's okay, rather than trying to humanize him and go, oh, well, he's a really great guy and he had such an innocent past and he didn't have a criminal record, so we should feel sorry for him or we should feel some sort of empathy towards him because he just got a really raw deal. And that's the same argument you hear from mostly non people of color when you hear these issues of people getting shot and killed, the stakes, state sanctioned violence that's happening to so many Black people. Well, you know, they really were trying to do what they needed to do, but they're a really nice guy, but you know, you shot and killed an innocent human being in cold blood that wasn't armed. So there's something going on in your psyche that's telling you that that's okay.
Right. Well, I think that I broke this down in the previous episode as well, but I think, you know, what was going on with this flashback, especially with a second watch, you kind of see that Bailey is, I don't know. There's a couple things going on. The first is that he was let go for the same exact offenses that Poussey was arrested for. Mm-hmm. So he's, you know, so that parallel can be drawn. He's being let go. You know, the cops are laughing and patting him on the back when he's smoking a joint, trespassing on property, where Poussey at the very end of the episode, you know, in her magical flashback, she's about to get arrested for the same exact thing and she will serve 6 years. Right. So there's that parallel between the two. And I think that his story, like I said, in the second watching, is watching how our society kind of casually promotes white male privilege. So, you know, and I think I just, for me, like, I didn't necessarily sympathize with him when I, you know, was watching the flashback. I think a lot of people were really confused as to why the flashback was there. And then in retrospect, I think that just like, there's a couple other things that I think maybe got lost in the shuffle this season, but I think that that is one of the big comparisons, the comparison between Poussey and Bailey as these two young kids who are basically fundamentally the same, but they get treated very, very differently in the eyes of our criminal system. So, you know, then you end up with the two of them, you know, in the situation at the end where there's change that needs to happen there, clearly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a great assessment, and I don't even disagree with that. I think that those parallels definitely make sense. I just would have liked to have known about, and again, I'm so sorry with the head cold, like my mind is not functioning at 100. But I would have liked to have known about like implicit racial bias, you know, those kinds of things that trigger these officers to think a certain way, to act a certain way, because I'm sure that Bailey would have functioned in a different manner had he not been exposed to, seeing images of Black people being vilified in the media, you know, all of the time. And sure, then that way I have to be excessive when I try to take down this Black woman, even though she's like a third of my size, I need to take her down in this very aggressive manner. So, you know, implicit racial bias exists, and that has yet to be explored. I haven't seen that really explored on a TV show. And that was a missed opportunity that they could have had in the writer's room. And who knows, had they had a Black person or a person of color in there, they could have brought something like that up.
Right. And I do think that is it's explored a very small amount where, you know, we're watching Poussey run around New York City and have this magical, wonderful evening that we all want to have in New York City someday. Like, I want to go to that club. but her, you know, it's a marked, you know, comparison to her body lying on the floor, getting cold, with obvious parallels to Trayvon Martin. But, you know, it also, we see the MCC team try to come up with something on her to show that she's, you know, villain, like you said, you know, this bias that the media sort of, you know, puts out there when things like this happen. And they can't really find anything, but they're looking for something. And I think that speaks to our 24-hour news cycle and how the 24-hour news cycle kind of just wants to distill everything down into these like basics, like everything's like good or bad. There's no in between because no one's paying attention, because no one has time to pay attention because there's a bazillion other things going on. And I think, like you said, you know, that bias feeds into everything else too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it dehumanizes people. I think victims, especially like you said, when they're people of color and when they're in a situation where they're in, you know, quote unquote, could be portrayed as doing something illegal because they're being paired with, you know, there's a cop in the situation. So obviously, oh, the cop is good, they're bad. So that's kind of what's going on there.
Right. And that was my takeaway from the flashbacks of Bailey. Like, they really wanted to try to dig in hard and let you know this is a good guy. You know, he got a bad deal. And again, I totally agree with your assessment there. But on the other hand, I just can't help but notice that was something that just I didn't felt like it belonged. And, you know, they've done it with other characters other male characters on the show. I mean, the whole rape storyline with Pasatucky was just ridiculous to me. And so, yeah, I don't feel like they do vilify the correctional officers enough on the show. But, you know, it's sort of like a satirized fiction. And I guess they go in certain directions that are more appealing to them than what's actually reality. But I feel like they should focus more on the women than having these nuanced stories on the male characters.
Right. And, you know, the Pensatucky and Charlie, you know, Charlie Donuts, I like to call him, but he, you know, like you said, there's definitely these layers of confusion going on. There's no black and white. Right. You know, I do think that in some cases, you know, like, I think that sort of, for me, at least when I'm like trying to think about it a little more critically, is that that sort of mirrors the women in or just people who are, you know, quote unquote criminals in general. Like, we're all, just in terms of my philosophy as like a counselor and just in life, is that like we're all a couple steps away from being each other in terms of like, you know, not necessarily. I mean, obviously there's racial bias in the justice system, obviously. But, you know, I think, you know, we're all a couple decisions away from doing something potentially illegal or something potentially life damaging. And I think that, you know, if you make this, you know, mistake is definitely a too light of a word to use for rape, but if you do this, the horrifying thing, can you ever kind of come back from it and learn? And I think, you know, that's the same with Pensatucky. She murdered a woman in cold blood, and you know, maybe she was a little drug addled or whatever was happening, but she committed a crime, and can she come back from that and be a good person? So that's kind of, I think, I mean, for me, like, when I try to extrapolate that, I'm like, okay, so this is being like, but like you're saying, and now I'm thinking about it, they're using two white men to make that example. They're not directly using any of the women, and especially not the women of color on the show, because Poussey is like this, you know, infallible character who's sweet and wonderful, and we never doubt her. Like, there's no shades of gray with her.
Yeah, yeah. And I totally realize I pronounced Pensatucky's name wrong when you...
Oh, that's
okay. I think I said Pasatucky.
No, you're good.
How off I am.
I got what you meant.
But yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And, you know, there's just that rape storyline with Pensatucky. Man, it was just so disturbing. I mean, the whole Stockholm Syndrome thing and the empathizing with your abuser thing. First of all, it's a huge trope. You know, in the 80s, it was overdone. General Hospital had one of the biggest storylines with Luke and Laura.
That song. And
yeah, I mean, they made it like this big event, and one of the highest rated episodes of all time was their wedding. And I mean, it's disgusting. But I don't know how or why in 2016 that they felt the need to do this kind of trope again and think that people would be okay with it. I mean, that's why rape culture exists, because, you know, somehow or another, it's believed that, well, you know, if I'm attacked by you and you're someone in power and I'm someone, you know, who is an inmate in prison, then somehow it's okay. And I think that's what they were implying, that somehow it's okay that this man that holds a position of authority can sexually violate this woman, and she doesn't have to report it. She can be compliant in it, and then they turn around and make her forgive him for the act. I mean, that was just, you know, you wonder why so many women don't report being sexually assaulted. So, yeah, I mean, there were so many things wrong with this with this season, between what happened with Pusey and Pennsylvania. But that storyline, yeah, that really hurt deep to so many women. And it's surprising that a writing staff with mostly women would co-sign on that.
Well, and we see in this episode too, I'm not sure if you remember, but there's a very brief scene with Nikki and Morello where they're like scouting out a place for a garden, and Nikki, who's been struggling with her opiate dependency and, you know, substance use all season, she's clean because obviously it's all knocked down and Red's cut off her supply, but she needs something. So she shoves Lorna up against a fence and like penetrates her with her fingers, and it's like two second scene, but then they're fine. And in watching it again, I was really kind of horrified by the fact that that could happen and just be brushed off so casually. And then, I was live tweeting the episode on Monday, and one of, you know, two people who are in the discussion kind of got into it back and forth about whether or not that was rape. And I was like, to me, that's very clearly rape. And to me, that's something that was not really dealt with. You know, it was just this throwaway scene, and watching it again and sort of, you know, obviously we're breaking it down on the podcast, but it's incredibly disturbing that it was just, especially in the same episode where, you know, Pennsylvania forgives her aggressor. So, you know, it's there's definitely problems with that in this episode.
Yeah. I mean, I think the only thing that they did get right, which really was their saving grace, was the character of Big Boo and the fact that she was very adamant about this was a rape. This guy sexually assaulted you, and that's not right. Otherwise, if it wasn't for that voice of reason, you know, this storyline would definitely lead people to believe that somehow she was, in fact, seeing this as a consensual act when it wasn't. And those blurred lines, that is why it is so pervasive, you know, in our country and in our culture, the assault of women, because there's just, sadly, I think patriarchy is a huge part of this, but I don't know. You can't even argue patriarchy in this case because there's women doing the writing, but it's just sad that somehow, this sexual violation of Pennsylvania was something that, you know, just isn't addressed. But they did do well with bringing in Big Boo. So I'm glad that her character was someone that actually had some sense to even use the word rape. So, yeah.
Right. And she's not forgiving.
No, not at all.
She's kind of like, I have my eyes on you. Like, you better not do anything. Like, I have to. But she's very respectful of her friend's decision to kind of do what she needs to do. She realizes that to push any more with Pennsylvania would be to push her away. So she wants to be there for her. And so, like, that's definitely like I love these little, I've been calling them, I think, like, unexpected relationships or something. They're just like these interesting friendships that blossom on the show. And that's definitely one of them that I really love.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many great relationships on this show. So
and like unexpected, just odd relationships.
Yeah.
And you know, Poussey and Brooke is another one, but they're done.
Yeah.
But yeah, and we, you know, we see Brooke and we see her, you know, drinking. She's really upset about the whole situation. All the ladies are kind of upset about the situation, but we also kind of see, which is like a not, which is a very expected relationship. We see the relationship between Alex and Piper in the episode, which like I am, and I think I like saw you tweet or something like or something where you were like, I'm done with Piper. Like, and I'm so like, I've been saying that this whole season. Like, I'm definitely like, you know, I definitely am done with her. Like, I, you know, if she, cause I was thinking at the beginning of the season, I was like, okay, how much time has this season passed and how much time has Piper had and blah, blah, blah. But it's like, if Piper got discharged, it would be fine. Like, the show would definitely go on and be perfectly fine for me.
I mean, I agree. It's funny. The author of the book, Piper Kerman, the character it's based on, she follows me on Twitter. And I'm very vocal about my opinions on Piper, because even though I know that she is the lead, the protagonist of the show, I feel like she was brought in to tell this story about these other women. And it shifted to really reflect that. So season one, yeah, she obviously her origin story, her background, what led her to these events that brought her to prison was very interesting to watch. But I don't see any purpose for Piper at this point as we go into season four. I mean, showing some of the shenanigans that she gets into, it's fun to watch. But I'd rather focus on these other characters and wonder what led them to go to prison. What are their motives? And we've been getting that with some of them, but I just want to see that reflected more and, provide some more space for those characters' narratives to be told than to continue to center the story around Piper, because at least the way they've been writing this show over the last four seasons now, it doesn't seem like it is Piper's story anymore, but they're like, oh, wait, hold on.
She's here.
She's here. She's got to be the lead. You know, she's the center character of this story. So let's insert her wherever we see fit to make sure and remind people that this is her story. But at this point, you've got an audience of people that have fallen in love with these other characters, where she's not really the center of the narrative, at least for them, and certainly not for me. I mean, I would love to know more about Suzanne. Unfortunately, Poussey, who was one of my favorite characters, I would have loved to have known more about her. Because she reflects very much so many of the women that are part of the Black Girl Nerds community. Like, to me, she was, in fact, a nerd. So,
well, she was a book nerd for sure.
She was a book nerd. She spoke different languages. You know, I mean, she's someone with a high IQ. She's funny. She's quirky. She's awkward. I mean, they took away the one character that so many of us identify with. And and that's a shame, because you don't see a lot of characters like her on TV. And she's queer. I mean, like, why are you doing this? So, yeah, it's just unfortunate that they decided to go down that path. But, yeah, I mean, Suzanne, Tasty, and even Daya, and, you know, even the Latina prisoners, like, there's just so many great stories with them, and they want to continue to insert Piper into those stories to remind you again, well, this is Piper's story, but is it really Piper's story now that we've gone into, you know, season four? I feel like it's more the prison.
Right. Well, and I was, so you mentioned Daya, and I was really shocked in season four, like, prepping for the podcast. I prepped before I got a, you know, obviously a chance to watch it. And I was like, okay, I need to like find people at DCF, Department of Children and Families, that I can speak to, because Daya's baby is going to be a big narrative in this season, because obviously the baby got taken away, and you know, Alita's gearing to get out, and you know, and then there was nothing. Like, literally, I don't even, they mentioned it maybe in passing a couple times. And you know, the episode with Alita is so great because we get to see this little microcosm of her getting out. And that's, you know, a whole thing. And yes. I'm hoping next season, especially Daya is in possession of the gun at the end of the episode, you know, and more in possession of it. She's holding two hostages. But, you know, I really do hope that we get to see more of her story. And especially with Alita out of prison, that we get to see the, you know, that family more. And that backstory a little bit.
Yeah, that was a great episode. I had just had a podcast that I'm doing that's going to be coming out soon, where we talked about that episode with her mom and that great flashback where mm-hmm. we kind of get a sense of who Alita is and her connection with Daya and the separation anxiety that happened when she drops her off mm-hmm. at camp. And, yeah. you know, it's I want to see more moments like that because then we really find out who these women are. They're not just these criminals, you know, mm-hmm. that these are, they're women that have stories, that have motives. And obviously there have been circumstances that have occurred in their lives that have led them up to being in prison. So, yeah, I would have loved to have seen more of that. And I'm sure we probably will. Mm-hmm. I'm even curious to know what's going on with the baby daddy.
Yeah, I think everyone was hoping he was coming back.
Yeah,
like, this season.
Yeah, like where did he go? He just kind of disappeared and just now is hanging out at How to Get Away with Murder and
and being Matt, a feminist and
being a feminist on Twitter and like you know talking about Black Lives Matter and stuff. So I'm curious to know what happened to his character.
Well, it was so funny because at the beginning of the season, they were like, we're going to bring in veterans. And I was like, yes, veterans. That's him because he's a veteran. And
right.
And so I was like, oh, my God, so excited. And then it was just a whole bunch of, you know, terrible people. Although you can argue that he's pretty terrible for having a relationship, you know, because Daya can't consent in prison and all that. But
exactly.
That's a whole other conversation. I still, you know, I would definitely be interested to see him come back. And, but he's a part of Daya's story now. Like because he's been gone for so long, he's like this auxiliary part of Daya's story. He's, you know, hopefully they make it about her and not about him.
Exactly.
If they do decide to reintroduce
Bennett,
him.
That's his name, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bennett, there we go. but just to kind of circle back to Alex and Piper for a minute, you know, I know that, you know, Jenji Cohen, the creator of the show, she said Piper was basically the Trojan horse to tell all these other stories. And you know, in a way she has been, and she's kind of fading back now. But like in this episode in particular, especially since it's the finale, it seems like they like need to give her something to do.
Yep.
So they give her and Alex this like weird quest with the name of her the guy who tried to come and kill her because she was friends with him. And I just felt, I didn't really feel, A, didn't really have a place for me. Mm-hmm. And B, just as someone, you know, who obviously, you know, follows the Black Lives Matter movement and things like that, it felt like kind of like a cheap like way to kind of bring that in from like a white perspective. Like I didn't love it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think the whole motif behind them trying to send everybody a message, well, this is going to be about Black Lives Matter, was cheap in itself. Like, from everything between Poussey's body being on the ground for hours, them trying to, you know, pay homage, I guess, to Mike Brown, to Tasty saying, you didn't say her name, you know, that's an homage to Sandra Bland. Mm-hmm. You know, and then obviously when she couldn't breathe and she got, you know, strangled mm-hmm. to death, Eric Garner. So, we get it. We understand what Black Lives Matter is.
Yeah, it was a little overkill.
You know, for us as people of color, we've been having this conversation for, mm-hmm. you know, years since Mike Brown's murder. That's what really sparked the Black mm-hmm. Lives Matter movement. But I think that this was white people's way of telling other white people about Black Lives Matter. And that's what was very problematic for most of us as people of color, right. Because it's like, well, we understand white people need to be educated, but why don't you either do it in a different way where you're not killing off a really profound mm-hmm. character, or kind of show why Black Lives Matter started, why there's racism in this country, instead of just saying, well, Black Lives Matter. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So yeah. I definitely felt like this was storytelling for white people. And as far as like Alex mm-hmm. and Piper is concerned, I feel like there's nothing left to do with Alex either. And I love mm-hmm. Alex. Like she's a great character, but it's just, you know, I did like the storyline between her and Lori Petty and mm-hmm. them exploring Lori Petty's character suffering from mental illness. And mm-hmm. At first, because I had done this podcast, I'd done it on my own podcast talking about how mm-hmm. I really didn't care for it much. But going back, I actually watched more episodes after I finished that show and actually do kind of, you know, respect the fact that they delved into that topic and they explored that. Cause that is, you know, a subject and that is, a topic that you just don't see played out in mm-hmm. a lot of fictional television. So I really do appreciate them doing that, going back and rewatching it again. So yeah, that was the only part of, you know, Alex being involved in a storyline that I thought was kind of cool, but it wasn't really Alex's storyline. So again, right. I just feel like I don't know why she's there either.
Yeah. I mean, they're just like, we need to do something with them and we need to integrate them into the finale because they're such big characters. And, you know, there's a right. big contingent out there of Vausman fans who are like ship them. And, you know, and that's a big part of the fandom of Orange is the New Black as well, just because people, you know, I say this almost on every podcast, but I feel like Orange is the New Black almost would be better served as like a weekly show because mm-hmm. people would talk about it in the breaks like they do with, you know, Mr. Robot or Game of Thrones or all those mega huge shows. You know, Orange is the New Black is arguably just as big as those shows. It just drops all at once.
That's true.
So we don't get the time. And, you know, people who have been listening to these episodes are like, shut up about it already. But, you know, I really feel like, you know, those would elicit the conversations if we were able to do that.
Yeah, I definitely do. I just I think the conversations would still stay the same though. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's, you know, people are still going to have gripes about, well, why is, you know, Piper in this scene and why do they have her doing this and that, and you know, what is Alex's motives here? And I mean, even going further back with Ruby Rose,
I mean, like that either.
She was boring to me. There was nothing mm-hmm. compelling about that character or that storyline. And again, it's just them trying to provide some kind of fodder for her character so that she can stay relevant, so she can stay as the center point of the narrative. But if there's nothing else left for her to do, it's okay to have her as a tertiary character mm-hmm. and then focus on, you know, the other women in prison. Best mm-hmm. season of Orange is the New Black was season 2. Mm-hmm. That was the best season. I mean, it focused on, you know, Tasty and Poussey and Suzanne and, oh gosh, I'm so sorry that my mind just...
V?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And V, and like, it just... That was a really refreshing new kind of storyline that, you know, we learned so much about those women and mm-hmm. we learned sort of the intricacies of, you know, dealing with prison politics, you know, and mm-hmm. beefs in prison. So I think people want to see more of that mm-hmm. than anything else. And you don't always have to focus on Piper, because I think at this point, at least, unless they come up with something really creative, I think Piper's story's kind of done for now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they could have her, like, you know, get discharged or you know, her sentence be completed, and then she could go out and write her book, and then that could be a thing for the people in the prison. Ah.
There you go. I mean, it is based on Piper Kerman's story, which is, you know, so... Just play it out like that. Yeah.
I think you're right. She's definitely, you know, she's definitely outlived her usefulness on the show, especially if she's gonna, you know, continue to fraternize with the people she's with and all of that too. So, I just that part where they're, you know, looking like the little hunt for all the pieces of paper and they're searching for them and then they burn, like that was just, I didn't really have any time for that in this episode. But you know, the rest of it was really great. You know, in addition to that, we see, because it's very compartmentalized in this episode, where we see people like kind of either dyads or like single people or small groups of people kind of processing this grief. Mm-hmm. And we're actually going to, you know, talk about the specifics of grief and loss on another episode with a grief counselor. But because there's so much about that in, you know, the way that the, you know, Cindy and I think her name's Allison, the Muslim girl, and mm-hmm. Watson are sort of processing their grief. So they're, you know, they're obviously, you know, they're sitting Shiva and sort of trying to work that out. But, you know, I think we also see Caputo and Tasty. Tasty kind of deals with the grief by going to work. She's like, I can't deal with this. I'm going to try to be of use somewhere. And she goes and she works with Caputo, which is like the best place for her to be, really.
Right.
And she's just so those scenes are like rewatching it. I, every time she was like interacting with Caputo, I was like crying because she's just emoting so beautifully. And it's all, you know, it's pretty genuine, I think, because she is friends with Samira Wiley in real life. But, right. but you know, those interactions between her and Caputo, like Caputo's like a, you know, pretend like kind of well-meaning white guy whose hands are tied. And then there's Tasty who is like feeling, like she's feeling it. And you see that, you know, that clash between the two of them.
Yeah, I, you know, Caputo is a very interesting character, and they've mm-hmm. done so well with writing his story and his backline. They did a really great job with writing his background and his storyline, mm-hmm. but I think they just kind of went off track with the whole romance that he had with that woman.
Oh, I like him and Fig. I don't know. She's interesting. So
it was weird. I mean, the romance was, you know, an interesting and very humorous storyline.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, you're talking about Linda, the lady from MCC.
Linda.
Oh, Linda, okay. Okay.
From, mm-hmm. Yeah. She, that was an interesting thing. But then the scene where, you know, they're in the house and, oh gosh, again, my mind is going. Please edit these parts out. what's Laverne Cox's character's name?
Oh god, see, now I'm gonna blank it. Sophia.
Sophia, there we mm-hmm. go. So the scene with Sophia's wife, when she comes to mm-hmm. Caputo's residence and he pulls a gun out on her, I just felt like that was really out of character. Like that doesn't seem like something.
Well, he doesn't pull the gun. Actually, it's Linda.
Or Linda. I'm sorry. Linda pulls out the. But then he doesn't do anything about it.
Yeah, and he's like turned on by powerful women. So
yeah, he was, and then he was turned on afterwards. And I just thought that was really out of character for Caputo, and it felt like they were, you know, I don't know. It just they went into some really weird direction between that whole storyline. So yeah, That was an odd, jarring experience for me seeing Caputo's role there.
Right. Yeah. And it's actually interesting because Linda, obviously, you know, at the end of the episode, she's in the prison with her gun because she's a visitor and she, you know, probably didn't get searched because it's all this chaos is going on. And so I think that's like the consensus that she's there and she has a gun and, you know, what's she going to do at the beginning of season 5. But, but you know, the interaction between Caputo and Tasty is just so like, I just think like, I love Danielle Brooks in this episode. I feel like she was like the heart of the episode. I feel like you know, obviously she kicks off the entire like crazy climax of the episode as well when she kind of loses it. She's like, she can't deal with the fact that Caputo doesn't name her friend and doesn't really like give her the, you know, the send off that she deserves in the media. And, you know, that's definitely a piggybacking off Black Lives Matter as well, too.
Right.
So, you know, she incites this totally justified riot.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, but so she, you know, incites the riot, and I, you know, I really love, or like you mentioned season 2 and season mm-hmm. the finale of season 2, like I feel like Orange is the New Black does the best cliffhangers.
Oh yeah, that was a great one.
Finale of season 2 is like one of my favorite cliffhangers of all time because it's like so satisfying yet it's like a cliffhanger. And so I loved that, and then this is also, you know, another for me it was pretty effective. You know, Tasty's rioting because of this injustice. You know, Linda's in the bathroom. All the girls come together with Judy King, and it's literally like all of the storylines from the season just coalescing and coming together in one hallway. But you know, it's just you know, aside, you know, we have Diet with the gun, and like I was talking about, you know, season 5.
Yeah, that was another weird out of character moment. I don't understand why they did that with Diet. Like it,
yeah.
It doesn't seem like something she would do. There's nothing in her past, as far as her being an inmate at Litchfield, you know, aside from her past outside of the four corners of the prison system, there's nothing that indicates that she would be aggressive enough to pull out a gun on someone, or that she was provoked enough to do something like that. I mean, can you blame it on, like, hormones?
I feel like we've seen her be impulsive, though. Like when, like, her mom went to jail and then Cesar or whatever was packaging the cocaine or heroin or whatever it was in their kitchen, and she just goes and she starts making out with it. So she is kind of an impulsive character.
Right.
So I think that that's part of
it. But is she
it,
impulsive like, in a very aggressive, even almost violent kind of way? That's...
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think one of the things that, again, a second viewing, and it's interesting because I never really watched Orange is the New Black over again. but now that I'm like watching them over, because, you know, you binge it and then you're like, oh, okay, I understand what
right.
went on and da da da. But it's definitely merits another watch, I think. But this, you know, that specific part where Caputo is giving the speech and Alita's watching, and then Tacy says she didn't even say her name, made me realize that Alita probably thinks it's Daya because she's the mom, so she's probably like doesn't know who died, and so she's probably really worried, and maybe Daya will die, and maybe that will be like the kicker of the beginning of season five. I don't know, but you know, I know that there's that question out there, like Alita is freaking out because right. I'm not a mom, but I'm sure I would be freaking out if they didn't say who died in a women's prison and my child was at a women's prison.
Right. I never thought about it like that. If they killed off Daya, though, I think there's going to be a lot of angry fans.
People would be furious.
Yeah, they'd lose a lot of viewers, too. I mean,
Pusey
and Daya back to back, that's just like, okay, alienate all of the women of color and people of color that watch your show. Just go on.
I know. That's just my crazy theory. But I thought it was interesting because obviously Daya's in this very risky situation at the very end of the episode. And Alita is thinking, like, maybe my daughter is dead. So so we have that parallel going on. So you know, that was... That was definitely interesting. I hope Daya doesn't die too. Daya is definitely one of my favorites. So I need to know what happens with her baby. Although,
yeah, like what's going on with the baby? Yeah.
Although if Daya did die, I guess Alita could kind of carry on that storyline, but we don't really. Or they'd bring back oh God, what's his name? Bennett. But then that would be awful. Like you said, that would definitely
like bring in the white guy to tell the woman of color story. Yeah,
that would be awful. So hopefully I'm not right. but yeah, so aside from Daya with the gun and all of these questions that we have for the, you know, the finale, you know, Pusey looks directly into the camera and everyone, the whole nation just sobs watching it and, you know, saying goodbye. But what do you feel that kind of represented or how did you feel watching those like last moments? Because I know you and I think seem to have, you know, we slightly, I mean, as everyone does, have slightly different reactions to the finale. So how did you feel when the kind of the closing scenes were rolling?
I was angry. I wasn't sad. I wasn't like emotional. I got emotional after talking about it with other Black women when we were having the podcast about this show. But when I first saw it, just my first visceral reaction was just anger. Like, why did they do that? And then trying to soften the blow by showing these moments of levity and showing her looking into the camera and breaking the fourth wall there and smiling like, you know, everything's going to be okay because you're no longer a part of this earthly world and you don't have to worry about being hurt anymore. You know, like, I don't want to see that. I want to see the relationship with her and So-So continue to grow. I want to see her have the opportunity to possibly get out of prison. You know, I would have loved to have learned more just about who Pusey was as a human being. And I won't get that. So, yeah, my reaction was just anger and confusion. Just like, I don't understand what the purpose here was. I think a lot of fans feel that way, too. I think a lot of us were just sort of just mystified by why this character was just suddenly removed from the story that has been building up over the last four seasons. And if the whole you know, if the end of the message was, well, Black Lives Matter, then that's a really poor way to, you know, end this character's story arc. It could have been mm-hmm. done in a myriad of ways. And to use one of the most prolific characters to do that is unfortunate. But then I heard like some, you know, discussions on the internet that there was some behind the scenes stuff and, you know, she wasn't happy with her contract or something. I mean, this could all be rumors.
Well, she's on You're the Worst now and she's doing an awesome job. So
yeah, I'm excited about that. And I know that her girlfriend is one of the writers on the show and wrote that very episode. So yeah, I don't know if there was like politics happening behind the scenes, but still, like, just, you know, as far as fans are concerned, that was just a big blow to all of us. So that was my reaction.
It's definitely, you know, I mean, and, you know, with the Black Lives Matter on top of all, like, the real life situation of the fact that Orange is the New Black has, you know, that death was very real. Like, it was rooted in, it, you know, like, the Black Lives Matter stuff is overkill, obviously, but it's reality. Whereas, you know, Game of Thrones, where Ramsay Bolton gets eaten by his dog, like, that's not reality. So, you know, that's a very different character, but, like, Ned Stark dies, and, like, he's a beloved character, and we all mourn, and it's upsetting. But, like, it's not rooted in any sort of reality that we can relate to. But, you know, especially with such a charged thing as Black Lives Matter, like, I can definitely understand your anger. And I kind of, you know, I was definitely upset at the end because I always have a really hard time when characters that I love die. So, so that's probably another reason we're going to do the grief and loss episode too, because I definitely think people should have time and like know that it's okay to grieve fictional characters, because especially in this case, because this is a big one for a lot of layered reasons. But on top of that, for me, like, I read an article from a writer, I won't say who it is, but was basically saying, like, this was a dream sequence, and Poussey was like, this is her afterlife, and da-da-da-da-da. And I was like, it's very clearly not, because this is the moment she looks into the camera, and I'm not sure if this was intentional or not, or I'm not sure if I'm even right, but to me, that's the moment right before she gets arrested, and her life gets cut down. And so she, to me, like, especially thinking about it over and over again as I was trying to, like, make sense of it after the episode, to me, again, that is the parallel between Bailey and Poussey, and the, like, how unfair it is that we cut these lives of these young African-American women and men short because of marijuana. How totally unfair that is. But I don't, like I said, I don't know if that assessment is correct, but I know she was trespassing in Brooklyn with marijuana, and that was what she was doing in the episode.
I think you're right. I think that that's probably exactly what happened. And I mean, just going back to, like, the Black Lives Matter conversation, for us, this was a very triggering thing to witness. You know, even though it was fictionalized and we know that, you know, once they hit cut that she's going to get back up and everything's okay. But seeing that image of Poussey's body on the ground like that. I mean, I remember the day that Mike Brown was shot and seeing my timeline flooded with images of his body, seeing Vine videos, you know, auto-playing on my Twitter feed. And to see those parallels, it really did trigger some emotions of fear and mostly, again, of anger. I was angry on that day that Mike Brown was killed. So, again, going back to what I said earlier, I feel like this story was written for white people and not really for a general audience. Because for us, as Black people, this isn't something that needs to be told to us. This isn't something that we need to learn a lesson from. Black Lives Matter is what we've been yelling and trying to get out to white people about since the homicide of Mike Brown. So, if anything, it just was sort of rubbing salt in the wound for many of us. And it was a hard watch. Because it's a reality of our lives as Black people, seeing these incidents happening and they're continuing to happen. But when you're a person of privilege and you don't have those experiences, or you don't know anybody within your sphere of influence that have those experiences, then you're like, oh, well, this is interesting. Well, this is different. Okay, this is the lesson that they're trying to promote in this particular story arc. I understand. I get it. So, you know, It's unfortunate that that's the direction that they decided to go to. But yeah, it definitely was a story for a certain audience that didn't reflect people that look like me.
Right. And you felt like it was manipulative to take away like one of the most, you know, complex female or, you know, African-American characters on the show in order to do that. And I definitely understand that. But kind of just to play devil's advocate for 1 minute, you know, in terms of reaching, you know, white people or people who maybe don't, you know, aren't on board with the Black Lives Matter movement. Mm-hmm. I do think just from, you know, being someone who's white, like I do think that it was effective in starting conversations for people and starting people thinking more critically about that movement and, you know, maybe even relating to it in a little bit of a way, because it is such a visceral, the way that they staged it and the way it was filmed, it was very effective in eliciting emotion, whether it was anger or grief or whatever. So I feel like having people, like white people, feel something about it is maybe effective in a way.
I think so. I mean, I definitely feel like this was a message sent to a specific audience. Mm-hmm. And it's good knowing that your perspective as a white person, that you were able to get that message and you're able to have conversations with other white people about Black Lives Matter and that this sparks a conversation. But if that's the case, they should have done it in a different way and not compromise a character that is just so not only appealing, but you just, again, you don't see characters like Poussey. I mean, she's a Black female, queer, nerdy, geeky, you know, speaks 4 different languages. She's a bookworm. You know, she wasn't like the other Black female inmates. You know, she wasn't a trope. I want to see more characters like that on television, and I don't. So you took the one thing that really attracted me to the show in general. I've had doubts about whether or not I plan to return to Orange is the New Black, to be honest with you,
that's a good question.
Yeah, after this season. So I'm not certain if I will or not. But I just feel like that this was a really bad way to send a message by taking away such a prolific character. And I think that there it could have just been done, you know, like an example of how it could be done in a different way is just, you know, using talking about the folks that are out there on the ground. I mean, you know, like if you really want to have a conversation, talk about why there are people like, you know, Colin Kaepernick that are electing to sit down or kneel for the national anthem and like go ahead and like dissect and try to figure out those stories rather than just killing off a really, you know, a fan favorite and going, well, you know, we killed off your favorite character. So we're sending the live, you know, the message that Black Lives Matter and you're going to have some really raw emotions towards this because we took one of your favorite characters away. So, you know, I just feel like that's kind of the direction that they wanted to go to kind of get you to get your emotions stirred up, but could have went a different route.
Right. And instead of, you know, lending nuance to the Black Lives Matter stuff, they were lending nuance to the two, like Bailey and Charlie, who were, you know, rapist and a murderer on the show, instead of lending nuance to that movement. And I fully understand that. I just, when I initially watched the show, you know, I definitely had a very different reaction. But like I said, I also have like a really hard time when fictional characters die. So, but I definitely understand that perspective as well though. And I, you know, I'm definitely interested to return to season 5, but I can understand why a lot of people are not. I mean, I think some people even that weren't put off, you know, by the, you know, Black Lives Matter story, I think some people were just put off by the fact that Poussey died because she's such a beloved character and people get mad when their favorite characters die.
Yeah.
I think it keeps
happening. And that's the thing. Like it keeps happening over and over again. There's been a lot of shows where a lot of queer characters have been killed off. Mm-hmm. Sleepy Hollow, they killed off the Black female character on that show. You know, it's very frustrating that marginalized characters where you just don't see them that often are just killed off. And, you know, you get the same monolithic images of white male characters that we've been seeing for decades. You know, let's give other, let's give fans the opportunity to see characters that look like them, that, mm-hmm. that have shared experiences. And yeah, I think that a lot of people that decide not to come back, is because of Pusey's death. And also I think too, people were really upset about the Pensatucky rape mm-hmm. storyline as well, because yeah. that was handled very carelessly. So,
mm-hmm. and yeah. we'll see, you know, we'll see how that evolves in the next season as well, because, you know, yeah. obviously something has to give there, but yeah. And I think, you know, I do think that one positive thing came out of this is that I like I said, Samira Wiley's on You're the Worst, which I absolutely love. And if yeah. anyone was listening who doesn't watch that show, you should watch that show. But, but I, you know, she's playing kind of another, like a black, not maybe as nuanced as Pusey is, obviously, because she's only been in two episodes, but she's a therapist, like, you know, mm-hmm. she's a working woman, she's mm-hmm. like got, she's a little quirky, and so I'm kind of happy that she's getting the chance to portray other types of, you know, nuanced black female characters, because she's, you know, she's great.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what I hope too is that they at least bring in another character that is similar to Pusey in mm-hmm. the next season. Like, at least if you're going to take her away from us, then bring in another character that is similar to her personality, similar to her quirks, so that way we don't feel like that is something that has been removed from the show. Because mm-hmm. Again, I think for many of us black women that don't fall into certain tropes that are always written about us from either the angry black woman or the sassy black woman. Mm-hmm.
Pusey was a breath, black woman.
Yeah, she was a breath of fresh air. Mm-hmm. So I would love to see interpretations of her character at least reflected in either a new character or, you know, do something, because mm-hmm. it's like a part of the show, like really the heart of the show, at least for me, just feel like that has been taken away. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
And for, I think, you know, I definitely miss her character as well. And that's definitely a big something that's been taken away, because there are kind of those nerdy, quirky characters on the show, but they're not. I mean, I would argue Daya's kind of like that, too. She's a little more.
Yeah, she's an artist. And mm-hmm. yeah,
she likes anime, and she's a little, you know, yeah. And if I thought about it, there's probably a couple more. But like you said, Pusey was so front and center, and she was the one that was taken away. But I think it's interesting, you know, now things are changing slowly. They're yeah. not changing all at once. But I know, you know, as you're talking about Pusey and all of the things that make her, you know, made her kind of really special, especially to the black girl nerds community, I think it sounds like, you know, like, oh God, what's it called? Insecure, Issa Rae's show that's coming
yeah.
out. It sounds like she's so kind of maybe like, maybe she can replace that in a bigger way in the pop culture zeitgeist, because she's, you know, her awkward black girl stuff and all of that. Like, I'm glad to see that kind of coming in to fill a space that we so desperately need filled.
I'm so excited for Insecure. Mm-hmm. I've been following Issa Rae's career forever, it feels like. And to see her go from making these like web videos mm-hmm. of Misadventures of Black Girl to having her own series. And then she signed like a 2-year deal with HBO, and mm-hmm. like she's really making moves. And the more types of shows that we see like that happening, that are being greenlit on HBO, the more opportunities for so many women to have their own projects greenlit. Mm-hmm. So I'm so happy for her, and I wish it all the best. I think Insecure is really going to be a game changer. I mean, just mm-hmm. looking at that trailer, I was just like, that is my life right there.
Yeah. Well, she's, you know, like you said, she's not one of those tropes. She's kind of, she's a real person. Like, she's a complex character that doesn't fall into any neat box. So, you know, I definitely look forward to more change as this, you know, as things progress. Maybe next year they'll hire some people of color on the Orange is the New Black staff in response in response to these conversations that people are having, and you know, maybe they can regain some of that viewership that they lost, because, you know, I think that they need to rebuild that trust in season 5.
I totally agree. I hope the actors continue to read my tweets. There's two actors that follow, Emily Althouse.
Oh, nice.
She follows, and Lori Petty recently followed. So and they're very woke. Mm-hmm. So they're all on top of it when it comes to Black Lives Matter and intersectionality and feminism and all of that. So I hope that they see the tweets that come out of my community and from others and be like, hey, you guys need to pay attention to what's happening on social media, mm-hmm. because, you know, this is your audience. You need to nurture them. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you're going to just alienate them, and then we won't really have a show much longer.
Right. And I think a lot of times, I mean, if I kind of extrapolate like to bigger shows like, you know, Game of Thrones, Walking Dead, like they've lost big contingents of their viewership in past yeah. years. And I think sometimes it's just kind of you make a bad decision and then it's hard to win people back. But I do think that Orange is the New Black has this ability to, you know, there are these real conversations going on with it. So it has yeah. the ability to kind of bring people back in a more organic way and tell stories that are a little bit more real, or maybe real to, you know, the Black community or whatever community, or, you know, just to us at large, because, you know, racism affects everyone. It doesn't just affect, yeah. you know, it doesn't. Doesn't just affect people of color, it affects everyone. And I think, you know, it's important for everyone to kind of look at things from different perspectives, whether or not they agree.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I hope the show bounce back. I don't want the show to fail. I don't want the show to suck. I just hope, you know, because it's a great show. It's a great premise. And you don't see many shows that feature so many different kinds of women, mm-mm. you know, so I really hope that they get their act together in the writer's room and really, again, focus more on the other inmates and not just try to insert everything with Piper's character, because mm-hmm. again, I don't even think it's really boils down to race. I just think it boils down to there's nothing else for her to do. Mm-hmm. And there's other characters who we don't know about that we would like to know more about their stories and why they're there. So if they focus on that, then they're definitely going to have some longevity. But if they continue on this same path, the way they've done in season 3, then in season as well as season 4.
Oh, season 3 was the worst.
Yeah, yeah. If they continue down the same path, they're just going to keep losing viewers, and mm-hmm. the show's not going to last very long. So
that's
I'm hoping for the best. I mean, I really do. Even though they screwed up this last season, I really do want this show to continue to have a large fan base and to continue to be successful. But they really need to get it right with writing characters of color and the Black female characters. They have to get that right. Otherwise, mm-hmm. we're out of there. Just like we're right. out of there with Sleepy Hollow. We're not going to Sleepy Hollow again.
Unfortunately, I didn't watch Sleepy Hollow, but it sounds, yeah, I mean, you know, things like that are definitely polarizing to you know, to communities that feel like I know the 100, I don't watch that either, but Lexa died, I think, and she was an LGBT character, and people yeah. were furious about that. And like, I definitely understand, you know, that I think it's called Barrier Queers, which is the movement there. And I, you know, I, or gays, sorry. And, you know, I definitely understand when you lose a character, it's hard.
It's hard,
but,
yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, they did, you know, they did take a swing this season and they missed, and hopefully they kind of come back from that and can, or, you know, with some people they connected and some people they missed, and hopefully they can just be more, a little more inclusive next year.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jamie, for your time and being on the podcast. This was a pleasure.
Yeah, it was. I'm sorry that I sound so congested that I couldn't really think of the characters' names and that I couldn't quite articulate myself in some moments. So I do blame it on the head cold. I'm not always like this. but I really appreciate the conversation. I love yeah. chatting about mm-hmm. TV, pop culture stuff. So this was great.
Yeah. Well, so where can listeners reach you?
Yes. So you can reach me either by way of Twitter. The Twitter handle is at Black Girl Nerds. Also, my personal Twitter is at Jamie Broadnax. And the website is blackgirlnerds.com. We also have a podcast that airs every week on Sundays. And mm-hmm. you can find that on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud.
Awesome. Very busy lady. So I really appreciate your time. But for us, you can find us on Twitter at You've Got Time Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/You've Got Time Podcast. And you can email us at You've Got Time Podcast @gmail.com.